So I'm going to jump us right back into the conversation. We've been, took a break and really just had an amazing opportunity to connect as families and friends and talk about our kids and talk about our lives. And you guys are digging into ancient Southwestern history and cultures. And so, you know, over an afternoon beer, I'm going to bring us back to the conversation here. And I want to ask you, Jamin, a little bit about the distribution platform, because it's something that I've not had any real understanding or integration or involvement with in the cannabis industry. We see so much from the soil side and dealing with all our farmer friends. And that's one piece that's kind of been an elusive thing that we don't talk about a lot. So can you fill me in and teach me a little bit about how the whole distribution networks really work here?
Yeah, that's a great question. I love talking about distribution. You know, in a lot of sense, there's parallels with distribution and just doing distribution and selling something, like, pretty much, you know, the ability to take something from a producer, package it, you know, spread it out, often is cases, and bring it out to multiple dispensaries or things. There's something to be said a lot about the network and how that starts to get built over time and who you kind of align yourself with. Because I think one of the things in distribution is there's a lot of product lines and a lot of different people have sort of gone into distribution looking at, like, how do I create a catalog of all the brands where I can go into a shop and give them everything? Where, as we've done distribution over time, we've started to look at how we can kind of fine tune things that are in Southern Oregon that we have access to and bring them up to urban markets and try to focus on kind of getting the products where they don't normally exist, where producers are, and getting them into areas where we can bring them into and get them into people's hands that are new. And we've come to some real big challenges where we don't currently have, you know, traditional cash where we can transfer between businesses with, you know, banking and different, you know, things that have been invented in that way. And we don't have ability to use shipping and UPS and FedEx. And so we've had to reinvent a lot of the wheel, which sounds kind of strange, where we have, like, typically in distribution, you'll have a sales team that does a lot of the actual delivery and you'll have them be the ones that are often the brand ambassadors. So salespeople start in distribution and cannabis start to become kind of like one of your most important people in the whole system, I would say, in the whole network. And then pairing them up with somebody who can kind of keep them efficient in the field is really important too, where sometimes I'll do like a 1-to-4 ratio and sometimes I'll do like a 1-to-2 ratio, where I'll have like multiple people who are running the computer systems and running the metric and being able to check product in and check stuff out of the warehouse and setting them up so that they can do these things called circular manifests, where they would run around doing stop after stop of showing things and then circling back and then doing the deliveries at those stops too. So what we typically do is we'll take on a brand. Like, maybe what I could do to talk a little bit about how the flow works is, like, a brand will typically call, we have an 800 number online, or they'll come through one of, like, our websites and saying, hey, we've got a product that we want you to bring. And we'll do kind of an introductory meeting with them and start to learn about their business. And if there's a good fit, we'll find, like, some of our partner dispensaries that we can start to bring the product to, like, maybe about 4 to 6 dispensaries, and start with a test market and say, like, you know, how's the price point of this product? How is it packaged? Because sometimes we'll find brands that are a great fit, but they just need a little bit of fine tuning around packaging or a price point or how they are actually brought out in with other products where we can pair them a little bit. So that's been really interesting to try to work in those areas. And I found that with genetics, it gives you a really, you can diversify farms with different genetics that you bring them. So there'll be different partnered groups that we have seed production with in Oregon, and we'll try to work with a farm and give them some specific genetics. I just did this Wye Desert Flower, where we gave them 4 strains. They're their exclusives. And now as they start to produce those, people will start to recognize them as part of their brand, which I think is really interesting to do.
I agree. I think that consistency in branding is super important. And, you know, I'm director of brand development at Royal Gold. And so we deal with distribution in such a different way than you have to. You're like talking about these hurdles, like, wow, I can't imagine having to network and consolidate internally the way cannabis distribution is. Like, we rely on our distribution partners to go out there and tell people about our product, and we throw it on a truck and it goes and lands for the distributor, and we have, you know, dozens and dozens of sales reps all over the country that are acting as kind of a proxy for our brand, but aren't employed by our brand. And that's, it's really interesting that there's so many more hurdles to that in the cannabis world. Once again, why is it so much harder for us or for the people doing this in cannabis than a traditional business? I just can't wrap my head around why these hurdles keep being placed on every stage.
I know, and a lot of times you'll say the hurdles are, you know, the ability to transport stuff with traditional methods, trucking, you know, other vendors and people that can just do distribution that way and ship things in boxes and put them in the postal stream. And then you'll find like, oh, it's the banking and the money. But there's also a real inconsistency with product too, where an amazing farm might have a bad batch. And it's kind of created a scenario where almost everything needs a hands-on approach to whether the decision's made on whether they take it, whether they're going to pass on that, whether they're going to pay one price or another, and even whether they might have a similar strain. Like, we've been in situations where we've come into a dispensary and they'll have a pretty common strain, you know, I don't know, GMO or something on the shelf already. And they'll say, hey, you know, like, we've already got GMO. We want to sell through this first before we bring your GMO in. And it could even be a GMO from outdoor, and ours could be a GMO from indoors. It could be totally different, but it confuses the customers, you know, when they come in and want that GMO. So it's one of the most important positions when you're running a dispensary is getting a good buying manager who really understands who the people are in the industry, what they do, and is willing to kind of take the time to sort of like look at every step of the way and make those decisions. You know, in the early days, we try, you know, you try things. You say, let's try to make a traditional wholesale company. Like, let's use a selling platform. Let's go online. Let's build a platform where people can go in. They can do e-commerce orders. They'll just show up. And we found it failed, actually, early on, you know. And we built probably multiple versions of e-commerce platforms and said to our vendors, like, hey, you know, you can always order online. You can get things. And now we've even seen groups that are like bigger, and that's all they focus on. Like LeafLink is a pretty big platform now that sells things through kind of like an Amazon, where you pay $300 a month. They give you a listing. A lot of the dispensaries will go on LeafLink and look, see the products that are, but they start to break when it comes to flower specifically. Yeah, you can get a very similar vape or a pretty similar edible product, but how is the flower, you know, really going to be distinct? What's the terpene profile? Did they cure it right? You know, how is this grow? Did they have bugs? And those things are really hard to tell without actually putting, you know, sniffing the bag, seeing the bag, holding it up. What's the appeal like and getting it in front of you? So a lot of the decisions buying managers make are really in person. They're split moment decisions. They probably take, you know, about 15 to 20 minutes a lot of times with our salesperson. They'll make the decision, and then literally invoices are being done, cash is being handed back and forth. You know, there's definitely times we'll get people net 30s. We, you know, it's pretty standard now as people are established, we trust them. But that little 30 minute of time frame is where in a normal industry, maybe four or five different parts of the business would have all functioned. You know, there would have been shipping involved. There would have been e-commerce orders. We don't have any of that really in place. So, and in a way, it's like we're reinventing the wheel in cannabis distribution, but we're also looking at distribution on how can we make this a little bit more personal? How can we solve some of these problems that don't exist, you know, when everything's just kind of looked at as a cog, you know, just as like a widget, because they're not. And so, like in cannabis, we see, you know, trim, B-bud, those start to fall in those categories, but people are really hands-on, and it's amazing. And I think having a really good salesperson that can talk about those things and the testing results and everything there and creating that presentation is important.
You know, you were saying having a really good salesperson and a big part of it is trying a product first. And that's what I've seen to be one of the biggest, hand-tying part of this whole thing is just, you know, the inability to sample product. You know, there's so many stipulations on being able to give away free product in cannabis. I don't know if it's like that in Oregon. I know in California, that's definitely.
Yeah, you can't just roll into a farm producer and like do on-site cannabis tastings.
Right.
They can't just like say, oh, here, try these six strains here, you know, and that is a huge hurdle. And I feel like so many other products like wine and, you know, other categories of products are so much more stable than flower.
Yeah.
And that's a really big hurdle too. Like you can look at it, it smells great, it tastes great, smoke some, we're good. When was it harvested? How much more shelf life do I have? How is this particular genetic going to hold up on its terpene profiles? How's it going to hold up on its THC numbers? And, you know, you're printing these numbers on a bag or on a, you know, prepackaged, especially in California, because we've discussed that it's a prepackaged state. Yep. Is that holding up 6-12 months down the road? Is that actual percentage still real? Because from the day you cross, it's right around 30 days, that curing platform, those numbers start to dive.
Yeah. You know, it's a really good point that you bring up how stuff degrades and changes. So, you know, in Oregon, we're going to get this initial test result, but has it been in the rep's vehicle? Has it been driven around the state? Have they really done the utmost care in terms of like, maybe they went into the diner and forgot to run the AC and it got kind of hot in the trunk, you know, or in the van where they had AC and they had sort of like climate control, but then it broke that one day or something. So we had a situation, we've had to replace some gummies, and there's certain times where we have to be really cautious about how we transport stuff, but the profiles will change going back to the testing. Like, doesn't CBN start to, you know, manifest after heat and time and different sort of like literally the test results are probably going to change, not just the terpene profile. And I think what's happened in Oregon is a real freshness element's occurred in the last couple years where I think things, there was always kind of like, oh, it's last year's harvest scenario, maybe for the outdoor folks. We've done a lot of work around preservation and curing and maybe even going as far as doing nitrogen packing or argon gases or different things that are going to stabilize it. But the big shift that I've seen is freshness. And I think that the shops that purchase generally lose interest after 2 or 3 months of a flower product. After, you'll continually go back and you'll literally, as a wholesaler, start lowering prices as stuff sat there after a couple of months of like, how do we get this out the door? How do we take stuff that was 22 for top shelf indoor, bring it down to 18 and start running it out? Because we know that producer has another batch that's getting trimmed right now. So the freshness element, it's tied in now, not just to the producers and them who are trying to get things done in a timely manner and out the door and off the farm and into distribution and into shops, but the actual wholesalers now are starting to really take those precautions and do things like climate controlled rooms, putting in air conditioners in places for product versus people, and putting climate controlled vans out on the road and trying to really be conscious of these elements. But there's nothing really beats just doing it fast, is what I found. It's just getting the product in, finding the right amount, spreading it around so that there aren't situations where you've got 20 pounds that are sitting in Southern Oregon, but they only want 5 and the other 15 are needed up north.
Yeah, and some accountability to that, I have to imagine, is difficult, especially when you're talking about, yeah, you've got relationships, you'll give somebody terms, like, all right, yeah, you know, you get 2% if you pay in 10 days, but you got 30. All right, 28 days is up and you're like, well, this isn't selling. I don't know what to do here. Like, how do we work this out? And you go back to check it out and you're like, well, this isn't what I gave you anymore.
You're right. And you know what's interesting in Oregon and probably a lot of states is there's no returns allowed a lot of times. That's really a customer thing. We actually will take returns at our dispensary because what you just described to us is kind of the worst thing that can happen. I don't want to sell something to a shop that's not going to be successful for it because it's just going to reflect bad on us and the producers and the whole channel. So having quarter pounds, having half pounds, having small amounts that they can to put a toe in the water with and just start to really see, is this going to work for us? you know, this is a new producer we haven't had before. Is it going to be a new strain? Maybe how successful is it going to be is important. And you know, you touched on a little bit earlier the consumption part. I mean, that's really the proof is in the puffing. I mean, you don't really know how good the weed is until you smoke it. And a lot of times you won't really know how good the weed is unless you go back to it after a couple of days, because it's not an immediate experience. It's a long-term experience. And a lot of the laws that exist in Oregon are legacy laws that relate to consumption in bars and liquor. And it's really different. I mean, somebody's at a bar, they're bartending, they're drinking behind the bar, they're going to get fucked up. They're not going to do their job well. If somebody's moderately smoking and bud tending, not just getting like fucking blown out and doing dabs all day, but like they can really perform well. It's just really different. And, you know, in the OHA days, they were in this really tricky kind of catch 22 in the medical days, where we had people who worked for us with medical cards, and some of them weren't even 21, because you could actually smoke, you could get a medical card at 18, where rec is 21. So they would say to us literally that these people had to go into like a private room. There could be nobody around. They had to smoke by themselves, but they were allowed to smoke at work. And when the OLCC came through, they've kind of changed the rules, eliminated public consumption. And we fought really hard for them to just allow sampling, so at least people could maybe make the decision and then the next day or two be able to come back and say, wow, that was really great, or that sucked, or whatever. But often, like, that 30-minute window is gone. Was the sale made or not? So it's still just that you're guessing, you know, what is it going to be good? Is it going to sell?
Yeah.
And I think it mainly puts pressure on the smaller farms without the reputation of the big farms, because everybody's going to be like, oh, you green, Wicked Kind, Focus North, like just buy it. Where nobody's ever heard of you, like it's tough. And that's the disadvantage of that. So I think by going and just creating a public consumption lounge, problem solved. Like, let people be able to smoke it a little bit before they're forced to put out significant outlay, thousands of dollars to purchase.
Yeah, give them relevant information to base their decision on.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's really important, because like we said, like showing up and tasting it, you're like, all right, cool, I'll take an eighth of that. I want to smoke it. Or maybe I'll take an ounce, but is it the same? Like, you might burn out on a strain after an ounce or two. You know, we experience this in Humboldt a lot, where people are like, oh man, this is great, but after a quarter, I don't want to smoke it anymore. That strain's over.
Yeah.
And so to give people those opportunities to kind of interact with the genetics and with the suppliers in a direct one-on-one way, I think is important. It is the way the industry has to go.
Yeah. Yeah, so, you know, I get a lot of calls for people daily, actually, just calling up and just saying, hey, we're a farm, we're a producer, we make gummies, just different products. We want to work with you at distribution. And, you know, when I pick up the phone, I always say to myself, this is never going to be a quick phone call. You know, I mean, I definitely get people that aren't in our industry that are trying to sell something like a new bag or a printing thing or something that, you know, can be a little bit of a quick call. But there's really a lot of one-on-one. You want to find out, like, are people pretty aligned with you on your kind of ethics and beliefs, and do they fit with the other brands? And we used to kind of have more of like a scatter or shotgun approach, where we just like, let's just bring it all in and see what happens. Where now we've really worked a lot more on curating brands, where we'll say, let's carry these four indoor farms, let's carry like four or five outdoor farms, we'll have two edible lines, a topical line, and trying to really create like a catalog that's got little bits of all the pieces but doesn't leave anybody out. Because it's pretty easy when somebody comes in to these short meetings, 30 minutes, and they have 100 products they want to try to tell somebody about, and then more than half of them aren't even mentioned or even shown samples of. So we try to have a smaller amount of brands, or even maybe have a larger catalog but only take parts of those brands to certain areas. So
yeah, it's hard not to water it down through your offerings. Like, you don't want everything you may offer might be of that equal value, but if you can't present it in that way, it once again provides that disservice to the smaller farmer who might not be able to tell their story as effectively.
Exactly. So, you know, we try to just give everybody an equal amount of love in these meetings when we get in there, and try to find things that will fit in. Try to get the salesperson to walk out on the store floor a little bit and walk around, see what other kind of products they have, and maybe notice that there's something that there's a category or a really cool brand that they're missing that we might have. So try to make it so that it works for them, because the best we can do is really set them up for success and then under promise and over deliver, I think is important too. Because I can't tell you how many times I've said, yeah, we'll get that to you tomorrow or something. And we've been able to do it. Try to do it same day if we can, you know, because it's, you know, when somebody's out of something, the customers are coming in, they're just going to go to that shop and they're going to leave, and then they're going to jump on Leafly or one of these websites. It's everything's pretty in the open now. You can find out the other shop what their catalog looks like. So there's a lot of shopping with the customers now where they're way more prepared than they used to be, which is nice, you know, in a lot of ways.
An educated, they know what they want. An educated consumer is a benefit to the entire industry, if you ask me. And we see that very often in phone calls we get in the office. And like you said, there's no short phone call. Somebody's like, hi, I'm doing this. What soil should I buy? I'm like, do you have an hour? Mm-hmm. Because I have 150 questions that I'm sure are going to prompt questions back to me. And like, let's go through it and really look at what fits you the most effectively for what you're trying to serve. And the rec market's very different than the medical market was in that way, because, you know, it's more fun. It's people are not as necessarily concerned about those things, where in the medical market, it was like, I need something that's going to put me to sleep because I'm experiencing this problem, or I need something that's going to help deal with pain in this area because this is what I'm dealing with and treating through cannabis. And, you know, it really changes the marketability, yet there's still those medical patients in the rec market trying to buy.
Right.
And that's really good that you do that with your soil, because I think that there are a lot of different ways of cultivating, and you make a soil for an outdoor grower, you don't make the same soil for an indoor grower or somebody who wants to work with like a 3 or 4 time a day feed, you know?
And some of that stuff changes, you know, with their program, you know, with their nutrient that they're using or even their strains that they're running, you know? And that's something that, you know, it serves me as somebody who is in the sales department for a soil company, where I can kind of give that one-on-one experience, you know, the customer service line's always open kind of thing. Don't call me at 2 a.m, but if you need to, you can call me at 2 a.m. And I want you to succeed, like you said, you know. But in our industry, we do have the method of, you know, sampling out, which is a huge part of it. You know, very similar to how being able to smoke it to really see if it's going to work this time and again in a week. You know, where with growing and using a medium, you know, you need to know that it's going to still be a viable medium for your plant to uptake nutrients properly in a month or in a month and a half, or, you know, the last 4 weeks of flowering. And sampling has been a huge part of that. You know, like when people can actually get their hands in it and actually see that it's going to work long term, they can actually commit to it, especially when it's a lot of money. You know, potting soil, it could be looked at as a lot of money. When you're buying cannabis from a dispensary with all the taxes that we talked about earlier, man, it's an expensive investment, you know, and to make sure that, you know, you're getting what you were hoping to pay for, it's a huge deal.
Yeah, it is. And I think with the soil sampling, I think it's super important because it's expensive, but I mean, you're building long-term customers that way because you're going to get it right.
That side-by-side and soil, oh, it's huge.
Yeah, we don't want you to use our soil if it's not going to work with your system. Like, we want people to be successful. People come up to us all the time and they're like, why would I do this? Why would I switch from this? I'm getting 3 pounds of light and this and that. I'm like, don't.
Yeah.
Well, I wouldn't switch if I were you. It sounds like you got a great thing going, man. Mm-hmm. High five. And they're like, well, but I'm interested in your product. You're like, well, try some side by side and see if it works for you then. Like, what are your goals? How is this product not living up to your goals? Like, what do you want to change in your system to accommodate this thing? So it's very different in the way soil is consumed versus cannabis. Sure. Because most people are like, I want to get high and not end up on the couch. Or I want to get high and end up on the couch. Yeah. You know, and that's, you know, there is a lot more nuance to that. But as a generality, I'd say that's pretty accurate for a lot of, you know, consumers who are in their infancy.
Yeah. And we actually get to do a lot of sampling, which is good. You know, I was chatting earlier just about it. We're not allowed to have, there's no on-site consumption, but we give out samples all the time in these meetings, and people take it home and smoke it or try it and decide whether they like it or not. And they're so beneficial to be able to do that. Just give things out, get it right, and then be able to stock them correctly. You know, on these calls, a lot of it, you can kind of make or break it based on the price, you know, and the price is really, it's kind of opaque. You know, if you're not running a dispensary and you're a producer, you know, what is the price? Are you going to go to your friend that has a farm down the road? Hey, what are you selling it for? And that's what we see a lot of folks kind of asking around, like, what's it selling for? What are the shops paying? But it's kind of, it's opaque. The shops don't want anybody to know their wholesale price, you know? Mm-hmm. So, you know, the wholesaler will have to do a lot of work in those areas of explaining margins and explaining kind of like what the price could start at and what it could actually be at if it doesn't move. And that's one of the things that's, it's a little bit of a tough conversation, because somebody's got a lot of pride in their work and it's beautiful at that moment and they want you to go and just get it all sold. But you have to set them up for the fact that there could be some variability in there. For instance, the Portland market's hotter. They'll generally pay a little bit more, maybe $2,000 to $4,000 $400 more a pound, I'd say, up there. We've seen pounds go for 3,000 up there. We're down here, you're probably like in the 22 to 2400 range at top.
Okay.
So, you know, knowing those things, knowing the different markets and kind of where they, the price points have to fall is super important. Because if I go into a shop with just a farm they haven't heard of and a number that's too high or too low, the low numbers can hurt them as well. So not just from the money that they're making, but people might not think it's quality.
Even if it's great product, the price is too low, I'm not interested.
Yeah.
Like, oh, that's that $10 weed. Where's the good stuff? And they're like, but that's the good stuff. This farmer just, you know, recognized this is their cost of production. This is their necessary margins. And this is what they're willing to sell it for because they want to move it.
Yeah. And it reminds me, you know, so I grew up in a family of artists. In a lot of ways, it reminds me of selling art. You know, it's like everything's a little different. And it's really the values in the eye of the beholder in a lot of ways. And so getting things in alignment with where they probably should be, and then getting it to kind of like work with that shop in terms of what, because you could, a lot of times I work backwards on things like that. I generally find that if you can go from the consumer on something, who's buying it off the shelf, what are they paying? And then everybody needs to eat, right? And there's a whole chain of people. There's, you know, the shop, the wholesaler, to the farm. Everybody needs to get an even cut to some degree to cover their expenses and make a little bit of money. So working back from those 14, 16, $18 grams on the top shelf to those $4 to maybe $8 grams kind of in the mids to bottom shelf, and finding out how that kind of translates. Like my tax account, I have a great tax account, and she'll tell me very straight up when I ran a dispensary, like, you got to double your money if you're going to survive because of 280E. You know, it's going to take a lot of the money in taxes.
Just sucks it right out.
It sucks it right out. So knowing those percentages early on and how the taxes affect each business, who's going to pay what they're willing, and also having knowledge of the black market. Because if the black market's selling pounds for 1,000 and we're selling them for 2,500, there's a disparity there that's going to get, it's going to affect the customers again.
Yeah, it's not going to fly.
It's not going to fly. Mm-hmm. So knowing those all, just being aware of all the different price points, trying to find things that works for everybody, where nobody's getting cut out of making money, is the recipe for success. So like, typically with wholesale, like how expensive it is, folks are wondering like what would be a margin for a wholesaler. We're typically running in the 20% range.
Which is low.
It's low. It's really low for a wholesaler. And that's a tough conversation I have with people, because people have grown a pound. They know they can go direct to a shop with it. 20% is a lot of money. And I have to explain, like, you know, a good salesperson is going to cost 60 minimum. That's not even that great of a sales guy. $100,000 a year. You know,
yes.
A good sales guy gets $100,000 a year.
Plus commissions.
So if I gave that person 10% of the overhead and I sold them, and they sell $1 million worth of weed, that's a lot. That's a significant amount of cannabis to sell $1 million.
For sure.
They're making $100,000. So think about how that margin breaks down. So we have licensing, we have, you know, all sorts of equipment, we have back end people, we have, you know, front end people, we have salespeople. It's expensive. We have vehicles.
Yeah. So it's not like oh, this is 100 grand out of a million.
Yeah.
No, the profit margin out of that million's 300 if you're lucky. Mm-hmm. You know, at a 30%-ish, you know, that's not exactly how the margin math works, but roughly.
Right.
You know, so you're giving away 30% of your profit to the sales guy? Like, that's crazy.
Yeah.
And it's just finding a way to make it all equate and take care of people and let everybody eat, because everybody does have to eat. But you also have to look at who's footing the bill, who's holding that dollar while everyone else works it out, who's the guy carrying the terms, and like, money costs money. So if you're a dispensary and you're getting to this on 30-day terms and you're wanting to make 30% margins, but you haven't even paid for it yet, like, that's all on the distributor to like foot that bill for you. And
yeah,
it's just chewing through their margins on both ends.
It is. And so like a really good salesperson who has a really small, and this is really important, like a really small territory, because we were, so Hylia at one point had 12 employees and we were able to divide up the territories into kind of micro regions. Like, so Portland had five territories actually.
Oh, wow.
Divided just Portland market up into. And we'd assign salespeople to those areas. And a good salesperson would probably do about $70,000 to $140,000 a year in sales. In profit. Put another zero behind that.
Right.
You know, that's about what they'll make, right?
Okay.
So, you know, they'll, let me just start from the beginning. So they'll do about maybe $500,000 to $700,000, $800,000. I've seen salespeople do $2 to $3 million if they're insanely good, really rare situations.
Yeah, they've got good clients. They're just hitting it.
Yeah. And those, you know, there's a lot of potential to be able to work with them in scenarios like that, but it has to be a really small region. They have to be able to have like contracts with shops where they're doing like 20 to 30 pound drops pretty regularly. And those scenarios are pretty rare. As we've seen companies like Cookies and Lemonade and other people start to come into Oregon, they've kind of created their own distribution networks. They've created their own growers, and it's essentially, that's where you can start to get into those numbers, is when you start to create those systems. So that's powerful, to be able to create these single state operators where you have a chain of distribution, dispensaries, and growers all working together.
It's all almost vertically integrated.
Yeah.
It's like, diagonally integrated.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not horizontal, but you know, there's connections in creating a market. I think it's interesting that you mentioned that, you know, Cookies model and how they're actually able to use licensing to create a national model where a lot of people can't approach that national market in that way. As producers, you can't approach it that way, but as a retailer, you can. So there's still these disparities that just have to work themselves out. And mm-hmm. What are we at, 34 states now that have some sort of legalized cannabis? Yeah. Like, we're so far over the hump of populist acceptance.
Mm-hmm.
So like, let's start teaching people what the business behind this is. And I feel enlightened by a lot of the way you've broken this down, because it wasn't how I pictured some of these distribution numbers after coming from a business where I deal with that. It's kind of broken.
Yeah, it really is kind of broken. I mean, it's crazy to think you've got your most valuable employee actually doing deliveries, but it's like, and doing the cash collection too. It's weird. So, you know, in those situations, you generally try to find ways to make it work and to create little cool things for everybody out of it. One of the things that's nice about giving net 30s out is the guarantee I'm getting back in the shop with a salesperson to collect the money and be able to offer more product to turn around and get another net 30 and just keep that cycle going, you know? So that's nice about the hands-on and being able to give product out in advance.
Yeah, you create this recurring visitation and like a platform that they know when to expect you. They know when to pay their bill. They're like, oh, they're coming in 10 days to pick this bill up. What are we going to want from them? Well, you know, let's get in. Let's check out their menu currently. And like, it creates a recurring customer at the distribution level. That's Kind of genius.
And you know, kind of like, what are the sales platforms in distribution? Like, how do people tell other dispensaries what's available and stuff? And it, you know, what we found, so we think really doing, so everybody likes to buy things different ways is what we found. You know, some dispensary buyers are very technical and love going on a website and clicking the checkout button and buying things in that type of experience. Others are, you know, looking to have a shop person come over and show them everything and very hands-on and want to like communicate over the phone. Other people send emails. Some folks are like really into just, you know, talking and like finding out about things and just not like, it's just all over the map on how people like to buy. So we send out a newsletter every like twice a month. We'll send out a newsletter. It's like a menu. It's really cool. It's got like photos and talks about all the products. It's got prices on and you can subscribe or unsubscribe to it. We'll have a website where people can view products and we'll do like, you know, vendor of the month. And then like, hey, check out like, you know, this cool shop we're trying to highlight and some things like that. And I'm looking at putting a new platform where I give a lot more control to the actual vendors themselves, where they can kind of run it like kind of like an Amazon a little bit. I hate to say it, but they're going to be able to add their own inventory. They're going to be able, and I want to make it for free. You know, I think like maybe some of the features we might charge a little bit of money for, but if I could just make it free, it's a listing service like Craigslist. It's not very expensive to run. So that's kind of what we're building right now. Wow. At devhighlydistributed.com. So that should be exciting.
Devhighlydistributed.com. That's, you know, you don't want to say Amazon, but like it's a successful model. And to be able to learn from these successful models and integrate what's the most effective, you know, manufacturer or retail methodology in major business for all products. Yeah, that's what we need to look at. And if the laws allow it, then cannabis industry can participate. But it's when those regulations, once again, get in the way and prevent us from utilizing existing models that everyone else gets to participate in, that it starts to get frustrating.
Yeah, you know, I actually have been back on Amazon again as a seller. So Amazon recruited my garden store 8 years ago. And sucked up a lot of data from us, and I knew kind of what they were doing. They were trying to learn our industry and pricing and things like that, and we ended up backing away. But I got back into it after the fire recently, just trying to fire sale some stuff. We sell a lot of Chickamauza scissors online, which are really hard to get right now on Amazon. And the things I've learned from Amazon that are really interesting is they have a really customer service centered model. They're really focused on the customer. And I think like problems are going to happen with distribution. I've had so many problems that would just pop up over little stuff that like often just throw a little, have a little bit of money to throw at it is the right thing to do, rather than arguing with somebody about whether they're right or you're right. And I think that's really helped us a lot in situations where something maybe went missing, there was a discrepancy over payments. Just side with the customer, just set it right, move on, you know. It's been kind of our model. I think that we see that on Amazon a lot. It's something I've really kind of learn a lot from Amazon, you know, and what they do is the customer-centric service approach.
Well, you have an opportunity at that moment to capture a customer for life or lose a customer for life, potentially, and there's very little in between. Like, you know, you either did them wrong completely and they're just done and they're going to find a new way to get their wares, or you're like, you know what, this wasn't right, we're going to make it right for you at our own expense, and they're like, you know what, we're going to stick with you. You did us right, and we're going to do you right every time. And I'm going to tell my friends, oh, have you checked out this brand? Man, I had an issue with them, and they took great care of me. And I feel like that is something that they do right.
Yeah, and I try to look at them as opportunities, you know, instead of like a negative thing now, where if it's like something goes wrong and we can really shine, we can maybe even make a little bit of an adjustment to a policy and say, there's our policy, but you know what? We're going to extend it, we're going to change it, and we're going to make you happy as a customer, you know? The cutoff date isn't 30 days anymore for return. You know, it's after that, here, we'll take it back anyways. You know, it goes a lot for like a long-term customer. And I think that's really what wholesale is based on, is building trust in so many ways, is like getting people to really believe you, because, you know, you have to deliver on time. You have to pay people. It's just regardless of what happens, it's how you build the trust in the community to be able to get people to give you the products and move it. But the margins have been tough, you know. I mean, I think it's all said and done, you know, maybe 3-5% is left after all that. And I think it's affected distribution in Oregon and possibly other places where we just don't see as many distribution companies anymore. I mean, when we started, I think there was probably 20 that sprang up. And I think out of all those, I'd say 3/4 of them are gone or more. Down in Southern Oregon, there's maybe 3 that are really doing it. When we used to have 7, one of them called us up 6 months ago and offered us all their vendors and employees because they were going out of business.
I've known people that work for distribution too, and it's just such a hard job. They're like, if it's not testing, you know, high 20s, nobody wants it. Like, I've got these really amazing products that I stand behind and I can't move them because of these numbers, and they won't even look at it or give it the time of day. And a lot of those people like eventually dropped out of the industry. They're like, this is worthless. I have no voice to my consumer. They're really not giving these products the time of day they need because of some arbitrary number that doesn't really necessarily affect the consumer experience as much as people may want to think. And I can see that with these people, these salespeople leaving the distribution companies, that, you know, the distribution companies then are like, I can't even keep employees.
Yeah. And how does that affect some of the genetics? Like OG Kush would be a great example of that, where it's a low tester. It looks like bee buds a lot of times, but they're little rock hard nugs. But I feel like some of the better strains of the old days have maybe not made the cut to rec because of these low testing numbers and the look. And it's some of the best weed there is out there.
And before the testing numbers were attached, you couldn't sell anything but OG.
OG Kush, I know.
Oh, yeah.
Because everybody wanted it because the consumer experience was real. It was tangible. Your neighbors stuck their head out the window like, what are you smoking?
Exactly. And so I think like overall, like the testing, I'm so glad that finally consumers are starting to get educated about not looking at testing numbers. And there was like this brief moment where it was like, what are the terpene numbers looking like? And then, you know, now I'm starting to see it shift to like farms and genetics, which I like, because, you know, there's just it's like people find a profile that they like. It's a lot of times pretty consistent. The farms are doing a great job on it. And then let's start working with those group of people, you know? Really excited to start to see those relationships forming and the education on the customer side, because I think that will bring back some of those old world genetics because of it.
I completely agree. And I think for the consumers at home, take note of that and like, wow, this farm's GMO is fantastic. Let's try another farm's GMO and let's try this farm's other genetics. And what are you liking? Are you liking what the farmer was doing? Are you liking that genetic? And how they were able to express it at this farm, is that what got you? Or is it, yeah, I like OG. I want to smoke OG all day. Like, I don't care who grows it. That's what I like. So like, find your farm or find your strain, but look at the difference and what is it that you actually like?
Yeah. And we're, you know, I mean, I got to say, we're not big into the CBD side, but maybe that's even been part of what's kind of opened people's mind to it, because it doesn't get you high, but it's got medicinal value. And so maybe by making that, you know, we've actually done quite a bit of work at our dispensary with cancer patients too and stuff, and having, you know, special tinctures and things that I think, you know, is kind of an untapped area. I want to see the industry get back into a little bit more.
Yeah. As my father battled cancer with cannabis and is here to talk about it today. And I do think that's being lost a little bit. Like, let's get back to some of these. Yeah, you should have some tinctures. You should have some capsules. You should have whole plant, you know, Simpson oil and some more refined products in the dispensary to really cater to those medical needs that, as the medical industry is kind of given way to rec, like we were saying earlier, I do feel like it's been compromised a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it has. And in Oregon, we're allowed to actually do medical through the distribution and CBD, as long as they're like OLCC registered and run through Metric, which is interesting. It's, you know, it's something we haven't really done a lot in. We've, you know, but there's, the future's bright, you know.
There are avenues.
There are.
Wow. This has been really enlightening to me, like having been friends for years now. Yeah. Like, this is conversation that, you know, you touch on a trade show floor, or when we run into each other out in the world, we can touch on bits and pieces. But to have this opportunity to like really dig into the nuts and bolts of how all these things affect the different industries throughout the ancillary cannabis products, actual cannabis products, producers and distributors. It's really enlightening to me. So
yeah, same.
I really appreciate this opportunity to come, and okay. Thanks for sharing your home with us and giving us this like fantastic opportunity to be here.
Your home is adorable. Property is beautiful. Southern Oregon is just epic. I mean, it really is just such a special slice of paradise on this planet.
The Applegate's lit down here, man. It's amazing. Paradise. Paradise. Yeah, thanks for the great questions and connecting again. And you guys are always welcome down, man. Southern Oregon welcomes you guys with open arms.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
It means the world to us. And, you know, thank you at home for joining us on Royal Grown Radio. We're glad you took the time to listen, watch, however you choose to consume the content we're throwing out there. We really appreciate you participating with us and being a part of the conversation. We call this a living conversation because we want it to evolve. We want you involved. So thanks once again for joining us.
Hey everybody, how's it going? This is Jamin. I want to introduce you to Royal Grown Radio. I'm from Rogue Farmers, Talent Health Club, Highly Distributed, and Essence Farm in the Applegate, Southern Oregon.